It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf announced last week $145 million will be distributed across the state to the hospitality industry, one of the industries hardest hit by the pandemic and the recession. Jared Bacher is president and CEO of Visit Pittsburgh, the official tourism agency for the region. He joins us now. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be with you.
We're approaching a year of the pandemic. The American Hotel and Lodging Association projects half of U.S. hotel rooms will remain empty through April. What sort of impact has there been on the industry locally?
Our hotel community, our hotel industry has been decimated over the last year, and it'll soon be over a year. We've tracked occupancy specifically in Allegheny County, and occupancy levels have plummeted really starting last March, where there's millions of fewer hotel rooms consumed over that last year, which has a tremendous economic impact, not just on the dollars spent in those hotels, but also on the tax dollars that we've lost on a city, county, and state level.
Mm-hmm. Who's getting hit the hardest? Is it the independent, the single unit, the single building hotels, or the chains? Are the chains more likely to have reserves? What?
The true impact is on the local property itself. All of these hotels are owned by someone or some entity. They all employ local employees. So it really doesn't impact a branded hotel versus an independent hotel more or less. It really depends on that particular hotel. But here in Allegheny County, we have seen a consistent impact across the board. There's some areas of Allegheny County that have been more successful, not successful, but more successful because of their location. Some of our hotels, for example, in Oakland have been used for dorm space for the University of Pittsburgh. So they have had a better year than others.
Mm-hmm. So are hotels trying new things besides lodging and dining to stay afloat? You mentioned some in Oakland serving as dorms, if you would. What about other hotels? Are they trying new tactics?
They've tried to do whatever they can by offering discounts or packages for individuals who want to come and get out of their home on the weekend. Others have offered hotel rooms as alternative workspace. It's been somewhat successful, but nowhere near driving the volume of business that they're accustomed to.
Mm-hmm. A recent study by the Allegheny Conference on Community Development indicated a slight rebound in June by the hospitality industry, but it didn't really gain any real traction since then. Is that what you're seeing?
Correct. We did see some increase in hotel performance when we were in August, September, October, that period of time where case counts, certainly within our region, were lower. We are expecting a slight increase in hotel occupancies going into the spring and into the summer, but industry-wide, it is expected that we won't see kind of robust recovery until we get into the third and fourth quarter of this year.
The state funding will be allocated based on county population. Allegheny County, of course, is second in population in the Commonwealth behind Philadelphia. Specifically, how much will this funding actually help?
It will help. It will help. You know, to use our current president's terminology, a lot of people see this as a down payment. You know, this $145 million doesn't go very far when you start divvying it up. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful program. It's certainly going to be welcomed by the community, but it's not going to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. That need to travel still exists, but there has to be a confidence that comes with that. And the only way we're going to get our industry back up and running again is through vaccination and building consumer confidence.
Vaccination. Almost half of consumers see the vaccine as an essential element of returning to a normal state of travel. Does that provide any hope as more and more people are getting vaccinated?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as you look at trends over the last year, whenever we've seen an uptick in cases, we have seen a decrease in travel confidence. So having more vaccinations into individuals, having the case counts and the number of deaths going down, that which we're seeing now, thankfully, while we're seeing that, we're also now seeing almost immediately an increase in consumer confidence when it comes to travel.
One of your main tasks is to help recruit conventions and conferences to come to Pittsburgh. Is there anything on the calendar for later this year?
There is. You know, we see a lot of opportunity for sports events. We've got the NCAA Frozen Four, which will be held at PPG Arena in April. And then leisure events, you know, there's a lot of discussion around events taking place over the summertime, including the Black Music Festival, which is scheduled to take place in June.
And the events that you just mentioned, festivals, sporting events, but that's also all due to if restrictions are lifted or at least eased a bit, right?
Correct. And we're seeing that. I mean, we all see this across the country where states are racing to ease restrictions. There's a lot of debate over whether that's the right approach or not. But we need to get back to a point where we have confidence in getting live events up and running again, because live events are so important to us as a society. They're so important to us as an economy. We can do it. We can get our live events back up and running, but we need to do it sensibly.
Jared Bacher is president and CEO of Visit Pittsburgh. Thanks for being with us.
Kevin, it's always a pleasure.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority is working to replace lead water lines throughout the city of Pittsburgh. But that task can be even more challenging if you're not sure where all of the lead lines are. Over the past year, PWSA has been collaborating with the University of Pittsburgh on a machine learning model to find and replace the lead lines. Michael Blackhurst is a research associate at Pitt's Center for Social and Urban Research. He's an engineer with expertise in water resource planning. Welcome to The Confluence, Mike.
Thank you, Kevin. It's wonderful to be here.
Since June 2016, PWSA has replaced more than 8,200 lead service lines. But both Mayor Peduto and PWSA officials have said on The Confluence, the maps about location of all the lead lines are incomplete. Is there any sense from working with PWSA about how many we might be talking about?
Well, in our modeling work, we attempted to predict the locations of all the lead lines in PWSA service area, and we found that the data and models weren't sufficient to predict the entire inventory. Our models predict a modest improvement over PWSA's historical records. I believe that the PWSA's historical records estimate about 63% of PWSA's customers' service lines are lead. We predict about 73%. We think there are better applications of the predictions than trying to estimate the entire inventory.
Mm-hmm. What types of data have you had to work with regarding where lead lines might be?
We compiled a host of potential indicators, things like property characteristics, such as when the house was built. It also includes administrative spatial data, so we can look at whether or not the presence of lead is spatially correlated. We had historical records of materials that PWSA provided, and we had tap water levels of lead in customers' homes.
You at the Center for Social and Urban Research and your colleagues at Pitt's School of Computing Information have been working on this machine learning model. So what was the idea on how it would work? How would take all this data and come up with probables?
Yeah, there's a two-step process to estimating whether or not a customer's service line is made from lead or not. The first is to collect a whole host of potential indicators and then estimate the probability that any given customer's service line is made from lead. And that involves the machine learning aspect of the work. Mm-hmm. The second step, which is a little more challenging, is determining at what probability do you deem a customer's service line to be lead or non-lead? Is it 50%? Is it 60%? Is it 70%? And that involves a mix of judgment and exploration of the results.
Your analysis of the data results in determining the probability, but then is it up to PWSA to say, okay, this might be a lead line. Let's dig it up and find out. What's the next step, or what have been the next steps?
Well, that's one of the most challenging aspects of applying the model, where you want to be very confident that if you were to excavate at a customer's homes and find lead, you would focus on those homes where the predicted probability is very high. And you would do a much better job of finding lead when excavating. The problem is there's few customers where the probability is very high. And so you risk leaving lead in the ground where the predicted probability is a little bit lower. So we think one of the best applications of the model is to plan a short-term cycle of replacements. So replacements for this year and next year, you could use the model to say which customers have the highest predicted probability of lead. And you don't have to worry as much about the judgment involved in deciding which probability separates lead from non-lead.
Have crews begun to dig up lines based on predictability as of yet, probability as of yet? And if so, have they discovered lead lines?
We did a field test of the data, and we basically confirmed what I just summarized, which is that where the predicted probability that a customer's home has a lead service line, it was above 80%. The model did a pretty good job. If the predicted probability is below 80%, the model did a mediocre job. Mm-hmm. Now, we can always retrain the model with data that are collected given a certain replacement cycle. So as PWSA excavates and replaces customer service lines, they get new data. And our hope is that PWSA would be interested in retraining the model with new data each year.
So at this point, will you continue to work with PWSA, or does that depend on what they find maybe this year?
That's totally up to them. We are happy to do that. We provided them with a set of locations that we expect to improve the model results. So if they were to diagnose materials at these locations that we provided to them, we would expect that to be an ideal data set to improve the model results. And we are certainly open to working with them. They have a lot on their plate, so we'll have to see whether or not they want to do another round of predictions.
Finally, as a research scientist, what do you still want to know about whether it's the model or just lead lines in the city of Pittsburgh?
What can we learn from a tap water concentration of lead at customers' homes? And it's a very passive, inexpensive way to start diagnosing the material at any given customer's homes. If we get multiple readings from the same home and we build up a big sample, the early results from our work suggest that tap water sampling could be a viable way to diagnose service line materials.
Michael Blackhurst is a research associate at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Social and Urban Research, and he's been working with the PWSA to predict where lead service lines are in the city so they can be replaced. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More scientific evidence suggests that in-person learning, especially for younger students, presents a low risk for spreading the coronavirus. But last month, Pittsburgh Public Schools delayed reopening at least until April. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins looks at the politics behind reopening schools.
Rebecca Rinaldo's oldest daughter was supposed to start kindergarten this year at Allegheny Traditional Academy. But because Pittsburgh Public Schools has continually pushed back reopening, her family had to make adjustments. Rinaldo and her husband cannot work from home, so they rely on grandparents' babysitting and other care. They pay the daycare provider they use for their two younger kids extra to supervise their oldest daughter's virtual education.
You know, instead of our daycare bill going down when our child entered kindergarten, it went up because we now have to pay the wonderful childcare workers at our daycare to provide a kindergarten experience for our child.
It's not ideal, but Rinaldo says she's impressed with the center's ability to manage about 100 kids safely.
They've had less than 5 COVID cases in the entire center since the pandemic began. So, yeah, the protocols work.
That experience raises a question a lot of parents are asking: why city schools can't follow similar protocols to get kids in classrooms now. Some critics blame the delayed reopening on teachers' unions, who they say prioritize teachers' health over students' needs. Colin Sharkey heads the American Association of Educators, a group with 20,000 members that often argues unions have too much power.
The teachers see this. They're watching these kids that they have been trying to help through the first part of last school year just fall back, and then some disappear. And I don't think anybody means that, but I think they're overlooking how devastating this is for kids based on concerns about possible exposure.
In Pennsylvania, teachers' unions are powerful. They gave about $6 million to state-level candidates in 2020 alone, according to the Campaign Finance Institute. Much of that money backed Democrats, who have kept quiet in the reopening debate. State Senator Lindsey Williams represents part of Pittsburgh and the North Hills. She worked for the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers before running for office.
I do understand that the teachers' union voice is loud, but I do think that school board members are hearing parents. We have these working families that are struggling. They want their kids in school. And unfortunately, because of a lack of a coordinated plan statewide and the inequities that already existed in our school system, we are further exacerbating those inequities.
She says one roadblock is access to the vaccine.
I've heard a school district official refer to it as fighting for an Xbox on Black Friday. So there are problems that the school district cannot control.
Educators are in the second priority group of Pennsylvania's vaccine rollout, but many in the first category haven't gotten their shots yet. Williams and teachers' unions say educators need priority within their group. Teachers also want additional protections before returning to school, like assurances that students will be physically distanced. Temple University professor Will Jordan says there's a long history of teachers fighting school districts for resources, and the coronavirus raises the stakes.
There tends to be extreme lack of trust between teachers and teachers' unions and the administration. The administration can say, okay, teachers, let's go back in. We're going to have ventilated rooms. We're going to have PPE. And I think that there's a lot of doubt as to whether that would actually happen.
Within urban districts like Pittsburgh, some buildings will need a lot more resources than others, and schools that serve mostly Black students are often in the most dire condition. Jordan says district officials would be calling attention to those inequities by taking a piecemeal approach to reopening.
I think that you'd be admitting that those schools that you tag to reopen are schools that are better resourced. And also, if there's some racial dynamic that depicts how those schools are different, that would just be a politically untenable place for people to be.
As a result, he says administrators often choose to keep their entire district closed. The Pittsburgh district's future is murky. When asked at a school board meeting last month about the plan to reopen in April, Superintendent Anthony Hamlet didn't provide one. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.